Hi, this is Bruce Valanche, and when I'm not being fierce and fabulous, I like to listen to Feast of Fun, my favorite podcast.
George Lucas commissioned the Star Wars Holiday Special with hopes of keeping the movie fresh in people's minds when he filmed The Empire Strikes Back. It aired on November 17, 1978, to dismal reviews, and is considered by many as one of the most awful and hilarious TV specials of all time. The special focuses on Chewbacca's family grunting and moaning with all of the original cast of Star Wars in awkward situations and many well-known comedy actors of the time in musical numbers.
Today we're talking to comedy writer and gay legend Bruce Valanche, who worked as a writer for the Star Wars Holiday Special and many lavish campy TV specials of the 1970s, including the Paul Lynde Halloween Special, The Cher Show, and the Brady Bunch Variety Hour.
As Hollywood's go-to guy for comedy writing, Bruce built a career writing for the Oscars and comedy legends like Bette Midler, Cher, and Joan Rivers.
Listen as Bruce talks to us about the wonderfully tacky world of TV specials from the 1970s. And he also reveals there is a documentary on the Star Wars Holiday Special in the works.
Why did B. Arthur get involved in the Star Wars Holiday Special?
What advice does Bruce have for Whoopi on Mel Gibson?
And the secret to Bruce's longevity in the entertainment business. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Chewbacca says that the Feast of Fun podcast would not be possible without generous support of people like you. Go to our website, feastoffun.com, and make a contribution or get yourself a fabulous t-shirt. Thank you.
Hi there, it's Bruce.
Hi, Bruce.
I was just going to call you, actually.
Oh, how nice.
It was such a delight to see you in Milwaukee at Pride Fest this past June.
It was fun.
Yeah, you really wowed the crowd.
That thing is huge. I had no idea.
Yeah, it was like a rock concert, but gay.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, they do three nights of it. I was kind of stunned.
You look fantastic, by the way. I have to say, it's like, I mean, you know, it's such a show business cliche. It's like, Billy Crystal, you look marvelous. By the way, did you come up with that line?
You look marvelous. No, actually, it was Billy. He did it on Saturday Night Live. Uh-huh. He was, you know, spent 1 year with Marty Short as regulars on Saturday Night Live. And that was when he, I think he introduced Fernando, loosely based on Fernando Lamas or Lamas. and that was him. That was totally him.
But, I mean, you've written for him and a bunch of divas and everybody under the sun. It's like they turn to you when they feel like they're not funny anymore.
Well, actually, you know, what happens is they start out and nobody wants them. And they have lots of time to write. And they do stuff. They write. They put their sentences together. And then suddenly they hit. And all of a sudden they have no time to write because everybody wants them. And that's when they start to take on a collaborator because they are tired of doing the old material. And there's no time to develop new stuff because they're so busy being stars. You know, when you're a star, you have to talk to Extra and Access and got to go do charity things and photo shoots and all this stuff that gets in the way of actually being creative.
Well, and so you're performing August 15th at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco for Northern California's largest annual AIDS benefit concert. Help is on the way. Do you have time to be funny?
I do, and I'm doing it everywhere I can. I'm in East Hampton this weekend with Florence Henderson.
Oh.
We're doing a show together called A Bipolar Evening because I used to write the Brady Bunch Variety Hour.
And you did?
And Brady Bunch stories to tell, and including whatever happened to Cousin Oliver.
Whatever happened to Cousin
Oliver? Well, he became me, and that's part of our act.
We have a...
That's part of the show. I try and make time every day to be uproarious.
Well, maybe you can answer this question. We have on DVD, we have the Brady Bunch Variety Hour.
Yeah.
It's the outside performance, and the father is
at
sitting
the Hollywood
there,
Bowl.
At the Hollywood Bowl.
He's with sitting, H.R. Puff and stuff.
Yes, and he's sitting there in the audience with Alice, and they both look like they're drinking scotch, and there's a person sitting next
Robert
to...
Reed Robert Reed is with Ann B. Davis, yeah. To be very mm-hmm. clear here.
Okay.
Okay.
And he's sitting next to somebody in the audience, and I swear to God, it's a drag queen. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't. Now, this is what, An outtake or something?
It was a DVD. It was like a shot of the audience.
It's not a DVD. It's the H.R. Puff and Stuff live at the Hollywood Bowl.
Okay.
And opening for H.R. Puff and Stuff, because they were the featured act, was the less popular act, which was the Brady Bunch Kids on tour.
Brady Kids, yeah.
And in the audience, because it was taped in Hollywood, was actor Robert Reed sitting next to Ann B. Davis, downing a big old thing of scotch as the camera quickly pans across the audience, and sitting next to him is this mannish looking woman with big hands. It's like Paul Lynde in drag.
Wow.
And so you didn't know anything about them? Or
no, that could have been his mother. he lived with her in South Pasadena, so it's entirely possible it was Mama Reed. But that was, H.R. Puff and Stuff was a Sid and Marty Krofft production, and the Brady Bunch Variety Hour was also a Sid and Marty Krofft, but that it actually came out of that Brady Kids act that was opening for H.R. Puff and Stuff. So they were there, obviously, to see the kids. Mm. And, they both enjoyed a cocktail when they weren't being Bradys.
Well, and when they didn't realize the cameras were going to cut away to them.
I'm surprised. Well, they probably realized it, but they probably were past caring.
You know when Robert Reed stopped caring is when he grew the mustache.
Is that the demarcation?
I think so. For me, it's like you could, because he was in character, he emoted, and then he grew that mustache. He let his hair get curly.
Yeah. Well, the mustache does all the work.
What he was basically saying to the world is, I'm gay, I'm going to go to disco, I'm going to have the sex I want, and hell be damned.
If he was saying that to the world was not responding with a hearty thumbs up. The world paid no attention. I mean, he was one of the most closeted people I know. He was saying it to you and me, maybe.
Mm. Well, he was saying it to himself, and that's what mattered. You know?
To stoned viewers of H.R. Puff and Stuff, of which there was no shortage, myself included.
Are you actually on stage with Florence Henderson during this?
I am, yes.
So it's something you guys worked on together.
We are working on it as we speak. It's an experiment in terror. She has a concert act that she's been doing for the last 2 years that I helped write, and we thought this would be just fun to try and combine it and add some Brady stories, since the whenever she gives the audience a chance to ask her questions, they all ask about the Brady Bunch. So
I want to know about her singing that old Black Magic on the Paul Lynde Halloween TV special.
She was on that, right? Yeah, she was.
Yes.
The best thing she did was cut, actually, from the. I wrote that special, too, you know. So she did it. At the time, Barbara Walters had just been installed as the news anchor for the ABC Evening News. And she was co-anchoring with Harry Reasoner, who was a crotchety old reporter. Mm. And they did not get along well. It didn't go well. And the next thing we knew, she'd come up with 2020. And had moved off of that. But this was, she and Paul Lynde played Barbara Walters and Harry Reasoner. They were encountering each other for the first time on the set of the Evening News and not having a good time. And it was a really funny sketch, but there just wasn't time for it. And it was just off of Halloween. It had nothing to do with Halloween. Mm-hmm. And it killed me that it didn't make it. And also, I think ABC cut it because they didn't want to make fun of Barbara.
It seemed like a lot of the writers of the Paul Lynde special, the Brady Bunch specials, and the Star Wars holiday special were stoned out of their minds.
Yes, and you'll notice I was on all three. it was in the late 70s. I mean, that was the period between 75 and 80 when everybody was comically altered.
Well, I mean, was Florence Henderson looking at the script and the Brady Bunch kids and going, are you sure that's what you want us to do?
That was frequently asked. Frequently asked, but those were the times. I mean, there were lots of wacky television specials being done, and everybody was just kind of looped, and it was kind of a surreal period.
Are you familiar with that Rock Hudson and B. Arthur did a skit together? And they were singing double entendres about drugs. Everybody these days is turning on.
Yeah. It's a song from a musical called I Love My Wife by Cy Coleman and Michael Stewart. And it's called Everyone Today is Turning On. And the show ran 2 years on Broadway. And it was about the suburban couples who get stoned for the first time and wife swap. And so that's an actual song from this Broadway show. The lyrics didn't have to be changed at all.
And when they actually performed that as part of a mainstream television special, didn't they think the American audience would say, you know, I think they're thinking about drugs?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the idea was that they were being hip and edgy. And of course, they could present it as they were just doing slang, or people who knew better knew that they were singing about drugs. But that was because, you know, the networks wanted to be with the audience. I mean, they knew what was going on out there in the world. So to have two older performers coming out and winking at the camera about all of this stuff was considered the height of hip.
Well, I want you guys to go on tour, you and Florence Henderson to go on tour and come to Chicago and everywhere around the country.
I want us to play stadiums.
Why were these variety shows so popular in the 70s? Was it because everybody was high? I mean, because you look at Rosie tried to reinvent it, and it just bombed.
Well, she didn't do a very good job. I mean, her heart's in the right place, but that wasn't a very well put together show.
Was she not high enough? Or is that
probably. That could be it. Just not high enough. That could be. They were always popular. They were among the first things done on television. So the 70s was the end of all of that. Cable put the death knell to variety television, because with cable you could see any your favorite artist. You could 24/7. I mean, you didn't need to wait for the Dean Martin show to watch Madonna. Madonna was available on MTV all hours of the day and night. And the specialness of those shows disappeared, because you could see those people everywhere. Back in the day, which is my favorite expression mm-hmm. that the kids use, you actually had to tune into Ed Sullivan to see the Beatles. You know, you had to watch Carol Burnett. You had to watch those shows in order to catch those acts, and they would all do their own specials to give you an idea of who they really were. And a lot of times those specials were just their concert acts packaged differently for television. But with the advent of HBO, you didn't have to package it differently. You could just bring a crew in, shoot your concert, and because you were on HBO, you didn't have to worry about standards. You didn't have to worry about whether you swore or whether your costumes were racy. And you didn't have to worry about the sponsor looking over your shoulder. I mean, I did a Barry Manilow special that was brought to you by Kraft Cheese. It was a Kraft Music Hall. And there were people from Kraft Cheese sitting on the set saying, I'm sorry, you have to zip up. There's too much cleavage. We have to change those costumes, those girls. I mean, these are guys who sell dairy products for a living. I said, by the way, that's a dairy product. But they didn't see it that way.
So Barry Manilow produces milk.
Oh, my God.
All right.
Yeah, so then everybody went to cable, because that's where the freedom was. It was no longer a big deal to see them on these other shows. So they began dying out. In fact, I did Donnie and Marie was probably the last of big successful new one that came along. It was in the last iteration of all of that stuff.
Didn't Sid and Marty Krofft also try to put the nail in the coffin with the Bay City Rollers?
They did a Bay City. Did they have a series?
Yeah, it was like a Saturday. It was sort of like
a series. I remember they had a special, but they did have a series.
Yeah,
I think is uh-huh. widely acknowledged as the nail in the coffin was Pink Lady and Jeff.
Oh, yeah.
Pink Lady was a Japanese singing duo, kind of like the girls in Mothra mm-hmm. who sing to the giant reptile.
Exactly.
And Jeff was Jeff Altman, who's a very, very funny comic who you can still hear on Letterman. He's a guy who calls into Letterman and does the weird traffic reports and the state police and all that. He's very funny. And they were paired on an NBC series, which is probably widely considered to be the low point. And I proudly just enough did not write it.
Bruce, it seems like you're responsible for all my favorite catastrophes or atrocities or
isn't it great
on television.
What a legacy.
And I really wish there were some sort of like Kennedy Center honors that we could bestow upon you.
The Port Authority honors.
You're responsible for probably the worst television special ever made, the Star Wars Holiday Special.
I know. I'm humbled.
What exactly was your role in that?
I was one of the writers. George Lucas had made Star Wars, and he was preparing The Empire Strikes Back. and he was worried that the franchise had gone a little soft, that people wouldn't keep up with it. He wanted there to be something to remind them in between those two movies. And at the time, network TV specials were big. There were only the three networks. And he sold CBS one of his stories. He told me at the time, I think he said he had 9 stories he had come up with, and he said he was going to film 6 of them, which after 25 years, he actually did film all 6 of them. But then there were a few left over, and he parceled them out to different areas of the business. One became a novel, one became an animated series, and one he sold to CBS for this this variety special. And it was about a holiday called Life Day that was celebrated in the galaxy a long time ago. And the lead characters were the Wookiees. And the problem with the Wookiees was that they don't speak any language that anyone can understand. You know, they sound like fat people having orgasms.
And they're not Christians. They don't celebrate Christmas.
They were going around and so they had to, you know, be translated by guest stars like Art Carney, who would stand next to a Wookiee and go, "How are you?" And, "Oh, good, I'm glad to hear that cleared up." You know, things like that. And that didn't make for a very intelligent script, needless to say. But it didn't really matter because people were tuning in for the outlandish special effects and the guest stars, who included Diane Carroll and Jefferson Starship and Cirque du Soleil.
And B. Arthur.
And B. Arthur as the woman who runs the canteen, the canteen on Tatooine.
You know, I was reading an interview with B. Arthur about that. She says she had no idea that was even for Star Wars. that she was friends with the writer of the music and said, "Hey, will you come over and just do this song?"
Uh-huh.
And later on she was like, "What did I get myself into?"
Well, she remembered it almost correctly. In fact, she was very friendly with Kenna Mitzi Welch, who wrote the song. She said she would only do the show if she could do a big dramatic number, because she was Maud at the time. And she'd come to Hollywood and television from Broadway, where she had, you know, significant musical theater chops. It was in the original Fiddler on the Roof and the original Mame and the original Three Penny Opera. That was where she had first broken out. And so she had her eyes on this Brecht song. Uh-huh. She said, "It's my Brecht Weil song." And I said, "It's your Weil Brecht song, is what it is." And she insisted on singing, and we couldn't get the rights to that. So Ken and Mitzi wrote another song that was kind of like the Alabama song, you know, "Moon of Alabama, so high up in the sky." Well, it was kind of like that, but there she was in the middle of all these aliens, you know, that George had pulled out of the Star Wars closet, and she was singing to all of them, and so it was kind of, it was so perverse, you know, it was like Snow White singing to the 7 dwarfs, except that they were all, you know, they all had, you know, snouts that looked like garden hoses and things like that.
Didn't she catch a clue when she walked into the set and saw that and said, "Maybe I might want to think this over"?
Oh, she knew what it was. I think she just forgot what it was afterwards.
Well, maybe she was stoned too.
Well, you know, B enjoyed a cocktail, I have to say. She did enjoy a cocktail. She didn't do them until after she worked, but then she did them a lot.
I was watching, and to prepare for this, I actually watched the entire Star Wars Holiday Special.
Wow.
Again. And I noticed that after the opening credits, there's actual no dialogue for the first 10 minutes. It's the Wookiees groaning at each other.
That's what.
What would the script look like? What did the script look like? Did they tell, like, the little person who was that played the child, Itchy, did they tell her, or no, it was Lumpy. Lumpy was the kid. Did they tell her? Yeah. Did they tell Lumpy, like, "Go over there and say moan"? I mean, was the moan scripted out, or was the stage direction?
It was all stage direction.
So it was all improvised moans.
And it said, Lumpy says, you know, and they would paraphrase what Lumpy had to say it just said, Lumpy said, you know, "Oh, I've just stepped on a nail." And so they would paraphrase what Lumpy would have to do, which would indicate the pain and suffering and whatever. But it was all indicated so it could be done by mime.
And to be clear here, the little person who played Lumpy, her name was Patty Maloney.
Patty Maloney, yeah.
Who is also well known for her appearances in Sid and Marty Krofft TV shows.
Sid and Marty Krofft regular, yeah.
And worked on probably a lot of the other things that you worked on.
She did. She was on Donnie Marie, and she was on a bunch of things. And she's a friend of mine.
Are you still friends to this
day? Yes, I am. We're friends to this day. In fact, a couple of students from North Carolina have made a documentary about the making of the Star Wars Holiday Special, which has taken a long time to make because they get no cooperation from George Lucas. In fact, they've gotten a couple of roadblocks from George Lucas. But they did come out west and interviewed all of us. They interviewed me and Patty and the director, Steve Binder, and a lot of other people who were involved in it.
So you haven't talked about with George Lucas about it because I find it hard to believe that he actually hates it or is trying to stop it, because he has a good sense of humor about the Star Wars franchise and has even licensed and cooperated with Robot Chicken and the Family Guy producers to do their parodies.
Yeah, I know. I think that because he did this one, he didn't like it. You know, he didn't like it at the time.
Mm.
And he thought it would go away, and he disliked it enough to buy up everything to make sure it didn't get seen. But I don't think even George anticipated YouTube.
So did he see it before it even aired on television?
Oh yeah,
okay.
He was around, and he was in and out, and he was involved with it. It was everything. Everything had his stamp of approval.
Even Harvey Korman in drag doing a cooking show.
Doing Julia Child, cooking with eight arms. Well, that was very hot at the time. You know, Dan Aykroyd was doing her on Saturday Night Live back then. And so, I mean, she was a very hot personality. And so it was a big laugh, actually, at the time. It was, as I recall, the only big laugh on that show was watching Harvey make a casserole with eight arms.
Do you think the documentary on the Star Wars Holiday Special will ever be finished?
Yeah, they'll finish it. I mean, I know that they're determined. They have a lot of footage.
Mm.
The question is what they can actually release. I mean, I think in a perfect world, they would like to have the footage that everybody is referring to, that shown, you know. I mean, without that, they've got a lot of people talking about something that the audience watching the documentary can't really connect because mm-hmm. they're not seeing the material that's being spoken of. And that, I think, is because George won't release it.
What's Carrie Fisher have? I mean, you're friends with her, too. You guys probably, you guys live close to each other, don't you?
That's kind of the low point of the show is when she sings that Life song.
Carrie? Well, you know, Carrie always wanted to sing. I mean, Carrie still sings. I mean, in her show, Wishful Drinking, she sings. I mean, Carrie started out, you know, as her parents' child, singing, show business, and she came to Broadway with her mother and Irene, who was in the chorus, and always wanted to have a singing career, and it didn't work out. But any opportunity she had, she would sing. And in fact, when George said, Carrie wants to sing, and she'll only be on the show if she can sing, so we had her come into the office and not audition, but just like show us a couple of things. She said she had some things she wanted to show us. And, of course, she had learned a bunch of Joni Mitchell songs. And this is just what you want Princess Leia to sing. I mean, Princess Leia singing, woke up, it was a Chelsea morning, the first thing of my mind. You know, and things like... the Joni Mitchell, the heavy Joni Mitchell stuff, like, mm-hmm. I could drink a case of you. and we listened, and she kind of, she played the piano, she played the guitar, and we reported back to George that perhaps an original piece would be a better, something that had to do with the show. And that was when he said, well, you could write a Life Day song.
As he took a big hit of that joint.
I think that he was contemplating actually getting, you know, another a holiday. Little did he know that at the same time he was doing that, they were cooking up Kwanzaa, which, you know, only happened like in the 70s and the 80s. But I think he was hoping that he could get another holiday going based on the Star Wars franchise. And the special aired Thanksgiving weekend, the Friday night of Thanksgiving weekend, I think in 77 or 78, I forget. And I think he was hoping that he would get a new holiday out of it, and he would be Irving Berlin with the first Life Day song.
He might not be too far off. I think in the UK, the fastest growing religion is Jedi. On the census, so it must be Life Day that they celebrate.
They call him a visionary. He knew He knew what he was doing, except the Ewok dolls didn't really move the way he hoped.
What's the star? Is there actual star date for Life Day? Do we know what day it is?
You know, there might be, but somehow I haven't retained.
Okay, I'll have to look that up on Wikipedia.
One of those things that I just did not hold on to. But she does, it's kind of a somber, melancholy little tune, isn't it, that she sings?
For a lot of people who don't know, it's counterpoint with the John Williams Star Wars theme. So they're playing the music slowly, and she's singing. Exactly. But she's singing. I actually just heard it last night. And I was like, I thought that was actually pretty creative and clever. Who actually put that together?
I believe that was Ken and Mitzi Welch again. They were they are a couple who wrote a lot of Carol Burnett's material. They wrote a lot of the special musical material for her show, all those 25-minute medleys that always told a story and would feature the guest stars. They did a lot of that, and I think that they actually, if I'm not mistaken, they wrote that song. I think they wrote that, and they wrote the original song for B. They may have written a couple of other original things for the show that I'm forgetting. But they, because I know Diane Carroll had a number, but I forget what it was.
She plays the same thing in The Wiz that she does in the Star Wars Holiday Special, I think.
What, an optical illusion?
Basically, she just kind of like materializes and sings her song and then disappears.
Wait, that's not Diane Carroll.
You're thinking of Lena Horne.
Sorry.
You'll edit that out, don't worry.
But it's kind of like the same thing, isn't it? Which came first? Did the Wiz steal that
Lena
from?
Lena Horne, I think, is some kind of good witch. She's kind of like Glinda
in The Wiz.
In The Wiz. I think she's the one who, like, you know, spurs Dorothy on, gets her back to Harlem, which is standing in for Kansas.
She puts her together, as they like to say.
I mean, Bruce, have you ever been approached by, like, some rich, you know, Gen Xer wanting to recreate the glory days of the variety special and write a film or something about this? Because
I would love to, you know? I mean, it would be fun. I mean, when you consider how much mileage they got out of My Favorite Year, which was essentially a movie about the Sid Caesar show.
Yeah.
It would, I'm sure there's a funny movie in one of these variety specials, but I wonder if you'd have to explain a lot to the audience who would wonder, what the hell show is this? Because it's so distant from most of them, they'd have to figure out what it all means.
Mm-hmm. Well, if people go to the website right now, feastoffun.com, we'll put together a collection of 10 of Bruce Vilanch's best moments in variety special land, including Florence Henderson.
Crash your computer. Your mainframe is in danger.
They'll be mostly hosted on YouTube, I'm sure.
Yeah, I wouldn't go near it if I were you. But, you know.
There are some of my favorite things on YouTube, actually. You're still working, and you still write for the Oscars.
I do, and I am writing again next year for the 22nd time.
And I heard that you actually, do you go to the Oscar parties that are with the celebrities? You don't actually go to somebody's house and watch the Oscars because you're doing it.
Well,
right?
I the last 21 years I've been at the Oscars, so backstage in the wings. So I'm not watching the show elsewhere. I'm there doing it. But I do go to parties afterwards, depending on how the show goes. You know, I always say that if the show is good, I go to every party I can.
Mm.
And if the show is not that great, I'm in a Bronco on the 405 heading for the Mexican border.
Because you're actually, like, writing jokes in the wings for some people, aren't you?
Sure.
Yeah.
How does that process work? Are you, like, typing on a computer? Are you writing on a piece of paper and shoving it into their hand?
All of the above. If it's something that has to happen really fast, we just, you know, don't even write it down. We just say it, and it occurs. So if it's we have enough time in advance, or if somebody wants something put into the teleprompter, then we have to dictate it to the prompter people. Or now we can actually email it to them, and it'll be, depending on how fast the net is that particular night, it'll be just as quick. But there are a number of ways we can do it. We haven't gotten the smoke signals yet, but that may be.
So, like, Steve Martin turns to you and says, "Oh God, I'm out. Fill me up,
no,
Bruce."
What will happen is something will occur on stage that we think is worth his commenting about. And generally, he will notice it before anybody else and turn and say, "I've got to have a joke about this," or, "What can I say about that?" And that's when we all start throwing lines at each other.
That's what we do around here when we're trying to come up with funny titles to the shows.
Yeah, but it's the same thing. Yeah, it's the same difference, except that with ours, there are like, you know, 100 people sitting and waiting. Mm. It's kind of like, I always compare it to the Super Bowl because it's the biggest show in the world, and everybody's waiting to see what play the coach will call.
What other comedians do you work alongside with or to come up with the funny stuff to say?
Well, I mean, I've done all the hosts of the show, of the Oscar show, and I've written with everything with Bette Midler for, I've worked with her for 40 years, which is difficult because she's only 32.
It's amazing how
do
you can
we do it.
Bending time.
Yes, I'm contractually obligated to mention that.
No, but so because but backstage, when you're actually trying to come up with something funny for the Oscars and you're with like a team of people, who are some of the other people you enjoy working
those
with?
Those other people. Oh.
Yeah.
Well, it all depends on who the host is, because the host chooses his favorites, his cohorts, his friends. Last year, for example, we had Dave Barry, who's a very good friend of Steve's. We've had Rita Rudner in the past. There's two terrific writers, John Max, who writes for Jay Leno on The Tonight Show, and Dave Boone, who wrote the Tony Awards this year, and also writes Dancing with the Stars, if you can believe it.
They have a writer for that show?
They do. They have all that, you know, all that stuff has to be. The judges have their scores. All that must be written.
So anything that Simon Cowell says on American Idol has probably been written by somebody else.
Maybe, I don't know. You know, I mean, at one point, Paula Abdul called me and asked me to help her come up, give her some zingers to throw at Simon. And I said, you don't need that because you don't do that well. And, you know, he's the one who throws the zingers. Mm. You're the one who should just, like, you know, react like he's just, you know, cut off your arm.
It's just not the same, is it?
I mean, they don't want you to come back with stuff. And if you come back with stuff, it's like, then you're opening up that, you know, that floodgate. And let him play that game with Seacrest.
I mean, it's not the same. I stopped watching it when she left.
Well, you know? I think a lot of other people did, too. And Ellen, as good as she is not the same. You know, you want that kind of insane energy. Mm. That was what was so entertaining about Paula, is that you never were quite sure if she was there or not.
Or what she was on something.
Yeah, and so they replaced it with a different energy that's not as entertaining. Mm. You know, Ellen is always there. Ellen is, you know, Ellen is hits the nail on the head every time. So she's not, it's a different kind of thing, and they needed to, I think, replace her with somebody who was as well-known and as sort of crazy. But now they got a bigger problem because they got to replace Simon, and he was basically, he was the only legitimate judge they have, you know, and the only one who would actually tell it like it was, and the only one that you really had to pay attention to because he was the only one who knew what he was talking about. The other guys are all cheery, but they don't know what they're talking about.
And there was a lot of discussion about this joke that was going to be done for the Oscars last year, Team Precious versus Team Mama T-shirt.
Yes.
What happened to that joke?
You know, we tried it out on various people, and not enough people had seen, not enough people got it, because not enough people had seen Precious, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. They all had seen the Twilight movies, and they knew what the team thing was. Or at least they knew about the team thing, even if they hadn't seen the Twilight movie. But they didn't really know about Precious, and so they just didn't get the joke. And we had another joke, which was even worse. It was Precious is about a girl who was raped by her father 2 times. Who says men can't commit?
Oh,
that was a joke that we all thought was hilarious, including the women in the room. Who, you know, there were some women writers. Carol Leifer was writing this year, and Beth Armageddon, and a few other women. And they all thought it was hilarious. But you just rape. There's just no way you can make a rape funny unless you're George Carlin and you know, you're doing a piece about making rape funny. Mm-hmm. It's just not. I mean, there are just too many people. Can't go there.
No, it is really hard to make a rape joke.
Can't go there.
Mm-hmm. It's funny until it happens to you.
I mean, I'm not advocating it. I'm just saying that I understand that. And while we thought it was really funny, but, you know, we were looking for something that was funny, so we thought that was...
Well, it's such a disturbing movie.
It's like Schindler's List. You mm-hmm. just can't make jokes about mm-hmm. it. It's the material is just too harsh.
Well, you can try to make jokes, and the problem is that people may not find it funny because they're so unnerved by the original source
material.
They'll
just write letters and they'll be angry.
But it's okay to piss off people sometimes, isn't it? I mean, that's what comedians do. You know?
Well, yeah, but it's, you know, what you don't want on the Academy Awards is a joke that makes the audience in the room go, ooh, like, we don't want to be a part of your bad taste, and we want to show you that we are better than you are, that while you, comic boy, may think this is funny, we serious filmmakers don't.
What's the joke that got you in the most trouble, or the thing that you were just like, ooh, I went there and people weren't too happy with it?
Well, there was a joke one year. We had a producer who loves themes. Some of the producers insist on assigning a theme to the show. And nobody really knows that this is even happening, except the producer does. And occasionally people will say, oh, the theme seemed to be thus and such. Well, so one year, a producer decided that this was going to be the year of the woman. And so there were lots of film clips and stuff emphasizing the role of women in the movie business, and it was the year Sharon Stone had done Basic Instinct, and Billy Crystal was hosting it, and he said, "And this is the year of the woman," and it's so ironic because the biggest part that people saw on screen all year was Sharon Stone.
And so, what was the joke that was made that got you in trouble?
That was the joke. The joke was, the biggest woman's part we saw all year was Sharon Stone.
Because she flashed her vagina.
She flashed her bush.
I forgot about that leg crossing scene.
At the time, it was all anybody talked about. So, I mean, literally, it was her breakout moment. Mm-hmm.
Bruce, it's really interesting that you've had this really long, elaborate, interesting career in an industry that's so characterized as fickle.
Yeah, I know.
And you know?
That must be because I'm classic. I don't know.
I mean, but it is sort of interesting because you were talking about how actors can, in another interview on YouTube, that you're saying that characterizing actors as paranoid or resentful because no matter how good they are, no matter how excellent they may be, they still may not get picked for these roles, and their fame and their success might be ephemeral because the next day the directors and the producers might be, we're going to go with someone else or something else.
Yeah, that's right.
So how do you manage to stay there?
To stay where? On the Oscar show? Or
yeah, just stay in your career, because, I mean, you're everywhere.
I'm adaptable. I'm flexible. Because I know how that kind of a show is done, and because I performed under pressure. And so there's a certain amount of trust, I think, that happens. And there's a certain amount of fear. When someone like Chris Rock or Jon Stewart or Ellen comes to that show, they're outside their comfort zone, and it's a big assignment. It's not like, you know, you can screw up on the People's Choice Awards, but if you screw up on the Oscars, it lives with you forever. So they all want to have people around them who've done it before. At the same time, they all want to have fresh people around too, and so they bring their own, you know, compatriots who are new to the thing, but they want to have a couple of old hands around, and I guess I have now fallen into that category of old hands, but they're busy hands.
Well, and you certainly get involved in also a lot of, you hosted the Grabby Awards, which is a gay porn awards here in Chicago. You are active in the leather community. You hosted IML here in Chicago.
Yes.
And even on our last show, you confessed that one of your biggest ways you spend money is on boys.
Well, you know, I have no children.
Well, so. But it's sort of interesting.
You've got to spend your money somewhere.
That so. You are
I'm sort of a one-man comic relief.
Bruce, you're a rare thing in Hollywood, is that you're a person who's very comfortable in expressing their gay sexuality. And also, I mean, you're not like Dustin Lance Black or Neil Patrick Harris gay. You are unapologetically embracing everything.
I know. I'm back in the alien. What can I tell you?
I'm
old enough to remember when gays were hedonistic and nothing else. And then we developed social responsibility. You know, I come from the generation that didn't want to get married, didn't want to have children, didn't want to go in the army. And now that's all we want to do. What happened to us? We got so square.
Well, I'm not square.
But I mean, at the same time, yeah. we're fighting for our civil rights, and that's what it's really all about. And I think that happened, to be serious for a nanosecond, mm-hmm. I think it happened because AIDS showed us how fragile life is, and we lost a lot of people who were young. And we lost them because there was so much hatred and discrimination and self-loathing. And we learned, we organized to combat this, and we took that organization and transferred it to a general political agenda. Yes, there is a homosexual agenda.
And it's fabulous.
Because that was the way we knew we would get our rights. I mean, nobody wanted to have anybody else be denied entrance to a hospital room of a dying partner. And that's where this all started.
But you also
a basic civil right that was being ignored. Nobody wanted to have to kiss their partner goodbye and then let the body be kidnapped by the family that hadn't spoken to him in 20 years and all of his property, et cetera, et cetera. That was what the AIDS epidemic showed us happened to second-class citizens. And that's when we determined that we were going to become first-class citizens.
And
that's why
the struggle for same-sex
marriage is so important, because it's about equality. It's about becoming first-class citizens. Our love is as valid as anybody else's.
Has it gotten easier to do what you need to do now than it was, you know, in the 70s with Paul Lynde and those, you know?
Well, it was a different era, and I mean, these things were unthought of back then. People keep saying, "Well, did you come out?" I said, "I never came out because there was never that platform. Nobody was out. Nobody walked around saying, hey, yoo-hoo, I blow people." it wasn't.
You wore a hanky that said it all.
That simply wasn't done. I mean, there was no place that you could gather that you would do such a thing. It was just something that was known about you or not. So the kind of things that Paul did were all very double entendre, and they winked at the audience, who assumed if they had half a brain that they knew what was going on, but the ones who weren't hip enough to realize what it was just went over their heads.
Mm-hmm.
Or they just thought, oh, look at that sissy.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was the innuendo, and it almost carried a lot of weight because people understood it and they could laugh at it. And I think in a lot of ways
but it was nothing overt. I mean, my biggest struggle on Hollywood Squares, which, you know, sounds like my struggle on Hollywood, Mein Kampf, my struggle on Hollywood Squares. I was licentious. You know, I was open about the fact that I had physical sex. That was something that Paul and those guys, Charles Nelson Reilly and Billy DeWolf and all of those funny, effeminate comedians never would actually allow themselves to say. It was all innuendo. I had the innuendo, but then I also, you know, I spoke like I shot from the hip. That's a bad phrase. I spoke the way, like I was having the kind of a sex life like everybody else was having a sex life.
Well, when you were on Hollywood Squares, did they give you the questions ahead of time? Because from what I understand, when Paul Lynde was doing it, they used to give him the questions. Then they took the questions away, and he's like, if you want it to be funny, you have to give us the questions ahead of time.
Well, because he was written for. I mean, one of my first jobs was writing for him.
Mm.
So
for Hollywood Squares?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would be doing Donnie and Marie, and we'd leave Donnie and Marie, and he would go to Hollywood Squares at night, and he would grab me and say, "Come with me to Squares. I haven't got shit." And we'd sit in the car and we'd write jokes.
Did you ever go out with Paul Lynde, like to a gay bar and hang out?
Oh yes. Well, he's famous for closing every gay bar in Utah, both of them.
Well.
Back in the day when we were, the Donnie Marie Show moved to Provo, Utah.
Oh.
Actually to a town called Orem, which is, we used to say, Orem is what you can't do in Provo.
What do you think about did you ever hear about the story that he was at Northwestern University here in Chicago, about to get an award, and he was standing in line at McDonald's, and there's an African-American man behind him. And he said, it was like, shouldn't you be behind? I guess the line wasn't moving fast enough. And he's like, shouldn't you be behind there working?
And so the African-American guy was actually a professor at Northwestern. So they took back the award and told him to get out of town.
I'd never heard that.
Yeah.
It would be totally within character.
Well, and so what do you hear about? Because everybody's sort of like all up in arms on Whoopi Goldberg defending Mel Gibson, who she's your BFF.
Yeah, she is.
And she said, here's her quote, "I don't like what he did here, but I know Mel, and I know he's not a racist. I have had a long friendship with Mel." And Marga Gomez said yesterday on our program that a really good solution is just to have Mel Gibson under house arrest at Whoopi Goldberg's house. What did you tell her when she said that?
I didn't say anything particularly because she does have a long friendship with him, and I think she even was more specific than that in the full statement. She says that he had been to her house and had interacted with her daughter and her grandchildren and was a part of their family at various family events, and that she didn't feel that he was a racist. So, This is her own personal experience, and I know it's difficult because it's difficult to separate what you know personally about somebody from this incident that happens, and while you can condemn the incident, your own personal experience of that individual doesn't jibe with it. It happens all the time. Listen, when we did that, when Ted Danson and Whoopi were a couple, and we did the blackface thing where he came out at the Friars and roasted her, the first thing that happened was people said, "Oh, Ted Danson's a racist." I said, "Excuse me, he's sleeping with Whoopi Goldberg for 2 years. Which part of this does not compute?"
Well, maybe are we trying to use the word racist when we're really trying to say, like, stupid?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, that's, you know? But we could say stupid, but no, we say racist because it involves people of different races.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it goes beyond the valley of stupidity. It goes into something which is more evil than just being stupid. But the fact is, he's anti-Semitic and he's homophobic, and he's in this case, he used a racist epithet. So who knows? Her personal experience of him? No. You know, did he ever look at her and call her the N-word? No.
I don't know if he would have.
Does that mean he never used it in anger in some other situation? No. I mean, these are not mutually exclusive. The problem is the people. So interested in branding everything black and white, they refuse to believe that everything is really gray, and that it's very difficult to paint somebody one color because they're nobody is that way. I mean,
well, when you go to her house for Thanksgiving dinner and he's there, do you guys like sit next to each other, or do they keep you apart?
We haven't been. I don't think Australians celebrate that.
Well, but I imagine that if she had a birthday party, she'd invite you guys. Bruce, we're running out of time. It's been a pleasure having you, and I hope that somebody out there with lots of money hires you to write a screenplay about your life's legacy and works. There is a documentary, Get Bruce.
Yeah.
That is has a lot of the celebrities talking about working with you, including Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
Billy D. Williams.
Billy D. Williams. I did work with him. I'm in Mahogany with him.
And, of course, Bette Midler.
And, Bruce, where are you going to be again this weekend with Florence Henderson?
I am in East Hampton, Long Island, at the Guildhall, the John Drew Theater of the Guildhall, on Saturday night. We will be carrying on.
And you'll also be at Help is on the Way on August 15th.
At the Herbst Theater as a benefit for the Richmond Ehrman AIDS Foundation in San Francisco.
Mm. And what are you singing a little song and dance with Carol Cook? Or?
No, I'm actually I'm reviving a number I did for them a few years ago that they, by popular demand, Everything is Beautiful at the Ballet.
Aww.
From a chorus line in which I get to wear a pink tutu. And show you the fastest tondequise in the business. I get to do it with all the chorus boys and dancers from Wicked.
Ooh.
Which has been playing in San Francisco, I think, since World War II.
I want pictures,
yeah.
Bruce.
Next time you're in Chicago, we got to hang out together.
All right.
We will do that. It's a promise.
Okay. You got it.
Sending you lots of love.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
What a delight.
Bruce Vilanch lives in Los Angeles, California. You can check him out Sunday, August the 15th at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco for Help is on the Way, Northern California's largest annual AIDS benefit concert. And it's going to be fantastic. Carol Channing will be there, Carol Cook, and Bruce Vilanch, and a lot of other fabulous people.
It's a really big show, that's for sure. I want to remind the listeners, too, that you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Just search Feast of Fun in the search bar and hit subscribe.
And it's just that easy. You'll never miss a delicious show. It'll be synchronizing with your iPhone, your iPod, or iPod Touch.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/feastoffun and on Facebook, facebook.com/feastoffun.
We're going to leave you here with Bruce Vilanch, the man himself, singing They All Look Alike from the album Jerome Kern, Life Upon the Wicked, available on our website, feastoffun.com. We salute you, Bruce, and all the fabulous people out there. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Bye-bye.
Now a little something by Jerome Kern. He could not be here this evening. He's in Malibu with Ann Miller. It was originally written for a woman, but so was Old Man River. But B. Arthur was booked that season. In days gone by, I used to be inclined for men's society. I would flirt and I would dance every time I got the chance. Athletic Jim taught me to swim. Jack drove me in his car. I'd stroll with Ned and golf with Ted. What dear good boys they are. But now, although with one accord, they try to please me, I'm just bored. For they all look alike to me now. Yes, they all look alike to me now. I used to feel as fond of them as I could be, but everything has changed somehow. I meet an old acquaintance, but no longer get a thrill. I say, hello there, Clarence. He tells me he is Bill. I see a man on Sunday and have forgotten him by Monday, for they all look alike to me now.